taking pleasure in itself, in its power. Seducing. Had Eric seen it too? How could he not? The exultation as she landed her last dizzying run, her feet bolting to the floor, face piped pink and exultant, radiant under the fluorescent lights. The look on her face as they all walked to the car after the meet had been a look Katie had never seen, nearly prurient. I finally got it! That's what it's supposed to feel like. It was almost too much for Katie. But Eric couldn't even look at his daughter, averting his eyes, dropping his keys, walking faster. Teddy, you just called?
Katie, I know you don't want to talk to me, he said, his voice scratchy like after a long coaching day. But she did want to talk to him. She needed to, before the detectives. She had to be first. I hope you heard about the paint chips.
He sounded like he'd aged 20 years in a few days.
We knew the truth had to come out. That eyewitness was a liar or a fool. Here's a fella been arrested twice for drinking Jack Daniels while under the influence of driving. Nearly lost his commercial license. Get this. Turns out he used to deliver for Gwen Weaver and she fired his sorry ass.
Teddy? Why did you call me?
Katie, we've brought Haley home to us.
She bowed her head, trying to concentrate, to think it through. I see, she said carefully. Because she's all better, just like that? He cleared his throat, a roar in her ear.
Katie, dear, we were hoping you and Eric might come over. That we all might talk.
Eric's not here.
I know Haley has some things she'd like to say.
Teddy, she said, I don't want to hear anything she has to say.
We'd really like you here,
he said, his tone unreadable.
The silver paint changes everything. I think you'll both want to hear what we have to say. We'll be waiting.
Chapter 19. Drew, I have to go out for a little while. In the den, her son's body was rooted deep into the springless furrows of the sofa, his pajama-clad arms swathed around a book. Okay, he said. I wonder who won. Won what? She said, tying her shoes briskly, thinking. The science fair, Drew said, a clicking from his throat, as if it still pained him. Last night. The science fair. She felt a pang in her chest, like pliers squeezing. I'm sorry, Drew. It's rotten being sick, isn't it? You can throw it all away, he said. The shrimp must all be dead. Like I said. Honey, she said, we'll get you back to school in a few days. There'll be another fair soon, right? But he just returned to his book. She looked at him, his head bent, the rosy crook of his neck, the slightly damp curls pressed there, reminding herself the scarlet fever wasn't her fault. But it felt like her fault. Everything did. Kneeling down behind the sofa back, her fingers reaching for his shoulders, she leaned over, glanced at the sentence next to his thumb, pink from the pressure, which meant he loved the book.
I'll tattoo you if it's the last thing I do. I'll do it for nothing.
Is that the one Mr. Watts gave you? Yeah, the melted coins, he said. It's mouth funny, but it's good. A pirate named Needles Ned tries to tattoo Joe. Drew, she tried. I need a favor. Turning the page back, he began reading aloud. Then he reached down and ripped open the boy's shirt. Give me the needle, Lopez. Katie heard her phone again, ringing again. Joe felt a stab of pain, Drew continued, as the tattoo artist crouched over him and the needle pricked the skin on his chest. Drew? First, I prick the design, then comes the dye. Drew flipped the page, found another highlight. The mark will stay with you for life, cried the pirate. Drew, honey, listen to me. I've got to go see Coach T for a little while. Mom, the tattoo ruins your life, he said, looking up. Once he puts it on you, you'll have bad luck forever. She could ask Mr. Watts to watch him, but she didn't want to. What had he meant, anyway? that she'd been standing at the screen door before the accident. That she... You have a tattoo, Mom?
I do, she said. Not a pretty one. Fight like a girl on her left thigh. She'd done it stick-and-poke style, with a sewing needle, and an Ashes vodka slurry when she was Devin's age.
Placing her hand on top of his head softly, she said, Pal, do you think you'd be okay here for a few minutes by yourself?
I thought when we went swimming that time.
It was a long time ago, she said. So the curse must be over.
A funny hitch in her voice.
And a pirate didn't give it to you?
No, she said. I gave it to myself.
Drew's always sticky phone in her hand, checking the battery charge, she explained again how to reach her, as if he hadn't called her hundreds of times.
It's only 9 blocks, she said, and Mr. Watts is next door if you need anything,
or if you just get lonely.
But I'll only be gone a half hour. I'm just at Coach T's.
Okay, he said, the book still between his fingers, his other hand scratching his temple, the rash peeling now like an overripe plum.
I'll be back before you know it, she said, opening the front door, car keys clutched in her hand.
It's just 9 blocks.
I think this is going to be my favorite book, he said.
That's good. It's nice to have a favorite book.
Ryan had a favorite book, he said. He kept it in his back pocket all the time.
Did he?
She looked outside at the quiet street. No sign of Mr. Watts or anyone at all.
You know he did, he said.
She turned, and for the first time ever, he looked at her like he knew she was lying. Which she was, though she wasn't sure why. But in that look, his eyes dark and sad. She knew something had ended. A great parental loss, the moment they realize you're not perfect, and maybe even a little worse.
In his back pocket, he added, watching her, squinting. You know it.
She sat in her car for a minute, staring up at the sprawling house, bright yellow with white trim, like a slab of coconut cake, layers piled high. The new cedar deck stretched twice the length of the entire first floor of the Knox's house. No sign of the detective's unmarked black Dodge. Katie smelled her shampoo first, like Love's Baby Soft. Then, walking across the softly carpeted living room, she saw her. Knees together, hands folded. Haley posed, swimmer's shoulders hidden in a bluish-pink Oxford shirt. Her face was paler than her usual golden girl glow, but she was meticulously groomed. Katie pictured Tina leaning over her niece, brushes and wands and implements, incanting some kind of brisk southern sorority girl magic, jerking Haley's curls into a long ponytail that looked as shiny as a girl's favorite doll, soft and staticky and over-tended, so Katie could see every brush mark. But something was wrong. One sandy spiral hung down, a forelock that didn't belong.
A big hank of her hair got torn out.
Artfully positioned to cover a bare patch, pink puckered.
Her scalp opened up where she hit the floor.
Okay, Katie said. Why am I here?
All three of them, sentry together on the sofa, heavily upholstered in bold plaid. Her uncle and aunt didn't look at Haley, and she didn't look at them. They all looked only at Katie, their eyes clear and inscrutable.
Eric wouldn't come, Teddy asked.
I told you he's at work.
You're going to have to deal with me.
Teddy nodded.
Then Tina, too, watching Katie closely with twinkling eyes.
Katie, we are thanking the heavens that Haley's name has been cleared.
Has it, Tina? Katie said, straightening herself, readying herself. Because my daughter's battered body suggests otherwise. Teddy's head bobbed in dramatic assent.
I know that none of this takes away what Haley did, laying her hand in anger on our Devon, he said, pointing at his niece, as though she were set in a pillory, face winsome and pleading. But Katie, can I ask you, do you know truly how you might behave if you lost the person who mattered most to you.
And you were the one blamed, Tina burst in, that you not only lose your true love in a horrific accident, but on top of it, you face this smear campaign, suspicion, rumors, dirty digs.
Teddy raised his arm in front of Tina like spotting the girls on the bars, and her mouth closed briskly.
Grief can drive you mad, Katie,
he said, taking a different tack.
That wasn't our Haley in the locker room with Devon. That was grief.
Well, Katie said, looking over at Haley, unable to stop herself. It sure looked like Haley when I pulled her off of my 4'10", 92-pound little girl. Turning her head slowly, Haley met Katie's gaze. Composed, enigmatic. Katie had never seen her like this. A young woman whose face had always been like soft taffy, stretched into smiles, laughter.
Come on, Jimmies, let's show 'em what we got!
But maybe that had been a composition, too. A mask. You never really knew anybody.
Katie,
Teddy said, clearing his throat, leaning forward.
I understand there have been some issues between Devon and Haley.
He turned to the first time to Haley.
But Haley was wrong about some things.
Katie looked over at Haley, her stillness.
And?
Teddy was still talking, his dulcet tones and bent brow, that mesmer coach thing he could do.
I need you to know she has not shared with the police any of the wrong things she once believed about your daughter.
Ron wouldn't let her, thank God,
Tina jumped in.
He said it would only have made things worse for her. It would have made her look a certain way. That's what Ron...
Teddy's arm came up once more.
And she will not be telling them now or ever, he said. None of us will.
Teddy and Tina looked earnestly, meaningfully at Katie, their matching pearly hair, their tanned skin, and finely laundered sportswear. Beside them, Haley. All three of them, their honeyed tans blurring together, the crispness of their shirts. All three becoming as one. A united front, confederates. That's what families were, weren't they? The strong ones, the ones that last. Not supporters or enablers so much as collaborators, accomplices, co-conspirators. Haley looked at her uncle, face benumbed, and nodded. A stuttering nod, like a record skipping.
Yes, Mrs. Knox, Haley said, nodding and nodding. I was wrong. I was wrong about everything. I behaved wrongly, and I believed false things.
There was a mysterious interlude, the passing around of footed glasses, the pouring of Tina's ambered sun tea, the entrance of Nadia and Nastia, Tina's snapping terriers. Nipping and licking at Katie's feet. Katie felt confused, lightheaded in a way she couldn't recall since she was a child when the dentist put that glorious sucking mask over her face, what he used to call happy hour. Now the talk was of the warming weather, the ragweed, the problems with their new deck, wood already splitting in the vertical posts. And did they need to sue the contractor? It was always something with these contractors, the workers they hired. Somewhere in it all, Haley disappeared into the kitchen, for napkins, for sugar, and never returned.
Where did she go?
Katie asked, head jerking backward. The temporary looseness in Teddy's bisque-colored jowls tightened, and he leaned toward her again, setting his glass on the table.
Katie, you don't worry about Haley. She had her come-to-Jesus moment locked in that unholy facility. That is over. And I get why Eric wouldn't come with you today, but maybe you can talk to him. About his plans for Devon and Bellstars.
Tina sprang forward, past Teddy's block this time.
John Ellis is a fraud, she shouted. He's tried to poach from us before. He's tried many times. The stories I could tell you about him. About how he's boarding one of his gymnasts, a 16-year-old. He says it's all proper, but she's posting pictures of herself on his waterbed.
Teddy's hand landed firmly on Tina's linen-shod knee, and her mouth shut again. He looked at Katie, those misty eyes he used to such strong effect during his pre-meet speeches.
Katie, gymnasts, all gymnasts, but especially the exceptional ones, thrive on routine, on fair winds and following seas. I can't apologize enough for our role in disrupting those waters for Devon. But we want things to go back.
His eyes glowing wetly, Katie feeling her chest swelling out of habit.
We want to return to those bright days when all our hearts and minds were directed toward elite qualifiers. We want what you want, for Devon to realize her deepest promise at last.
On his feet now, lifting Katie to her feet too, holding her hands in his, between his.
With your say-so, we start over now. We refocus all our efforts. Forget all this confusion. Leave it in the darkness. Remove any obstacles from our champion's way. Return to our path, the one we mapped out together all those years ago. All of us together. Right here in this house. At that table in there.
Katie looked through the arched entry into the dining room. She could see it. Eric and herself leaning forward nervously, watching Teddy with his Sharpie, his flowchart, deciding Devon's future. She felt something turn inside her. A phantom kick to the ribs. At that moment, a sharp thwack vibrated from the ceiling, and something else, almost like an animal scratching a carpet on the floor above them.
"You say the word, and the minute you leave," Teddy said as if he hadn't noticed.
Could he really not notice?
"Bang goes the starter pistol. We are back."
Tina was on her feet now, too, her hand on Katie's shoulder, the hard pebble of her engagement ring pressing there, talking loudly into Katie's ear, loudly over the thudding of a door over and over again upstairs.
"Practice at 2:45 sharp as ever," Tina said. "Devon back where she belongs."
Upstairs a brief lull came, before the ceiling itself seemed to shake from a fathoms deep, from the bellows, sobbing.
"And I promise you this,"
Teddy intoned, moving closer to her, all their bodies nearly touching as if in prayer.
"I will devote every fiber of my being, every cell of this aging body, every drop of my heart's blood to making Devon a senior elite in 1 month's time. She will have it. I leave it in your hands."
What could she say?
What else could you possibly say?
This is how it is, Katie thought, sitting in the parked car, not ready to turn the key. Our shared effort. The things we all do to keep following that sharpied arrow. It made her think of something from months back. She'd come upon Eric and Teddy in the living room, watching footage from Devon's failed bid for Junior Elite 2 years ago. Their faces lit by the screen, Eric's hand on the remote, pausing on every frame of the vault. Hurtling down the runway, round off. Feet slapping board, rocketing backward, hands hitting table, body rising, left arm down, right elbow lifted, and then twisting, arms close to chest, spinning madly like a lathe. Then landing, legs fused on the mat. Again and again, the frame palsied on that landing, the slightest of ankle rolls, the half step at most. A decade of work, an inch. Two, of blue foam.
"That's always been her Achilles heel," Teddy had said. "That foot, it makes her work the other one too hard. It's like she can't bear how wrong that foot is."
"The foot's not wrong," Eric had replied, eyes on the screen.
"The foot's everything."
Still sitting in her car, from the corner of her eye, she saw a blonde blur speeding past the Belfour's side deck, the one she'd stood on after Ryan's funeral. Pound, 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 across the deck, the sharp twang of the small dive board. A swelling plunge, a splash from the chemical depths of the Belfour pool. Exiting the car, Katie walked quickly up the lawn and through the arbor. Just then, Haley emerged from the water and climbed, shirt and jeans drenched, up the ladder.
"Hey," Katie said. "I need to ask you something."
Sweeping her hair back with her hands, the pectoral fins of a slender dolphin, she looked over at Katie, chin trembling. Katie could see the stippled spot on the scalp where the hair was gone, the purple under her eye where Devon's teeth had been.
"They'll see you," Haley hissed, eyes darting toward the house. "They see everything."
Her pink shirt stuck to her brown skin, Haley sat, dripping, in Katie's passenger seat.
"Mrs. Knox, I can't talk to you," she said, the wetness like a presence, a third thing in the car. "I made promises. I made my promises. And I'm taking the pills, and I'm moving back home with them. I'm getting my act together."
"Maybe you've convinced them," Katie said, "but I'm not convinced.
How do I know you're not going to wake up tomorrow and call those detectives or come after my daughter again?
Haley shook her head, water scattering across Katie's arm.
I'm not saying a word.
I'm never saying anything. What would it get me, Mrs. Knox?
Katie said nothing for a second, watching Haley, her eyes pinned, her hands tucked under her soaked jeans. She looked like a teenage girl gone wrong, caught and cowed.
Mrs. Knox, I don't know what happened to Ryan, Haley said, eyes flitting up the slope to her uncle's house.
I didn't ask, but I do know about Ryan and your daughter, and I'm not talking about it. Not ever.
So can I leave now? Can I?
But why?
Katie knew she shouldn't ask. She couldn't stop herself.
Why would you do that?
They took care of me, Haley said. Uncle Teddy and Aunt Tina. When I was Devin's age, younger, you know how babies, when they first come out, you swaddle them to keep them from scratching themselves, from scarring themselves? That's what it was like.
Katie felt her phone vibrating under her hand, but didn't dare look. Instead, she focused on the browning half-moon under Haley's eyes. Had Devin really bitten her?
And they're still here, looking after me, even after everything the last week.
Then a funny look passed over her face. A shadow. Something.
I should have listened to Aunt Tina. She never trusted Ryan. A whistling girl and a crowing hen always come to a bad end, she said.
She looked over at Katie, a smile lurking, rueful and sharp-toothed.
The night it happened, I thought he was going to propose. I thought that's why he picked the nice restaurant. But he picked it so I wouldn't make a scene when he broke up with me.
Wait. Wait.
I spent the rest of the night sobbing my heart out. Then I find out he's dead, and I want to die from how bad it hurts.
She shook her head, the scattering of droplets, her eyes chlorine red.
Then the day of the funeral I get this call from Ahi Jewelers. They saw my name in the death notice and called me up. Ryan had ordered something but hadn't picked it up. So I got there, and you can guess what I'm expecting.
Katie took a breath.
A ring.
Sure. And what do I find instead?
She reached into the nearly sealed wet pocket of her jeans, yanking something out. She then slapped it in her other palm.
I can't seem to stop carrying it around.
It was a necklace, gold plate. It was cheap, a girl's mall necklace, a pendant dangling at the end, a tiger figurine. A tiger, like the poster in Devin's room. A tiger like her lucky stuffed animal, plush and matted. A tiger for Devin. Its haunches spreading, its legs poised as if about to vault. Small as a peanut, Ryan had said to Katie that time about Devin. But strong as a tiger.
Eye of the goddamn tiger! Just like her stupid routine,
Haley said, staring at the necklace.
I slammed my fist on Ahi's glass counter and cracked it. They said I had to leave.
You're lying, Katie said, shaking her head. You knew about them before he died. You'd been sending her texts.
You sent her texts the night he died.
She looked at Katie, head tilted, still holding the necklace, the tiger spinning in the air between them.
No. I found out when I went to the jeweler, the day of the funeral.
That's not true. Katie said, thoughts churning, remembering Ryan's funeral reception, Haley thumping on the glass, demanding things.
I never sent her any texts, Mrs. Knox. I had no idea about Devin. That's how dumb I was. I should have known. Everything's always about Devin, for all of us. Right? My uncle, my boyfriend, those booster parasites. It's all about Devin and that fierce little body of hers and that deformed foot. Everything depends on it.
You're a pathetic girl, Katie blurted. You're a pathetic little girl.
Isn't it something?
Haley said, her gaze returning to the tiger necklace, her breathing harder now.
The things we do for our family.
Reaching out, Katie grabbed for the necklace so forcefully Haley flinched.
Jesus,
Haley said, holding her wrist.
Jesus!
But Katie had the necklace and held it, just like the leotard, she would not let it go.
Keep it,
Haley said. I don't want it. It disgusts me. Maybe it's made me lose my mind this last week. Maybe now it'll stop.
I think you should go back inside, Katie said. Now.
A look of revelation appeared on Haley's face, a knowing look that made Katie crazy.
I was so mad when I was younger, she said. And then you grow up, and you think you're not that girl anymore. The girl you were at 15, 16, angry and nasty, hungry for love.
I guess some girls are like that, Katie said coolly.
But the thing is, you're always that girl, Haley said, stepping out of the car. She never goes away. She's inside you all the time.
That girl is forever. Haley touched the violet half-circle under her eye, the bite mark. It was like Devin's mouth was there, screaming. Get out of here, Katie said, turning the key in the ignition. On her lap, she saw it. Missed call. Eric. A prickling feeling around her temples, spreading hotly through her skull.
Mrs. Knox?
One last thing, Haley was saying from the curb, hands still on the open door.
You know what I kept thinking when I saw you at the funeral?
I don't care, Haley.
I was thinking I had it all wrong. That night after regionals in January. The tiki party, remember?
Yes, Katie said, hand on the gear shift, a queasy feeling. Of course she remembered. All the women hoping to dance with Ryan, the air in the catering hall muzzy with mom perfume, rum, promise.
I had it all wrong, Haley said, fingers wrapped around the window edge. I thought it was you I had to worry about. The way you danced with Ryan, your skirt inching up so he could see your tattoo, sharing cigarettes in the back hallway. Whispering in his ear.
What? What? Her face burning, her cheeks so hot, the heat in the car suddenly everywhere.
I don't know what you're talking about. But it turned out it was Devin. You're a little slut of a daughter. It wasn't you he chose. It was Devin.
Katie looked at her, breathing, breathing.
It was never you, said Haley.
And Katie lifted her foot from the brake. Haley jolting backward, stumbling on the pavement, Katie said the words from some deep well and unstoppable.
You come near my daughter again. I'll break your neck.
That tiki party again. Always telescoping back to that night, months ago. An evening of heat and pleasures for all of them, for everyone. Everyone with their stolen moments, playful ones. Teddy, Kirsten, and Bobby V flicking bottle caps for cash in the back alley. Molly and Jim Chu making out like teenagers. She'd seen Eric with his hand on the small of Gwen Weaver's back.
So what had been wrong about dancing with Ryan? And enjoying it, the feeling, the sureness with which she could feel his heart beating behind the laundry-worn cotton of his shirt.
It wasn't like Haley said, none of it. Pulling over, she picked up her phone. Clicked. The Bellstar's Facebook page shimmered. Fingered a screen, she scrolled through all the pictures, every meet, pool party, pancake breakfast, and yes, the tiki party. The flare of the torches. Teddy limboing with Molly Chu. Devin beaming under a blaze of paper lanterns, under Eric's proud gaze. Now that everyone had a camera in the palm of their hand, there were photos of everything. There were photos even when you thought no one else was there. Like the blurred one of the dance floor. Becca Plonsky, Jim Chu leading some kind of conga line. Crouching over the phone, pushing her face close, she spotted Ryan and a woman in the background, in the hall by the restrooms. Such a grin on the woman's face. No, on her own face. Oh, yes, that. She might not have remembered ever but for the photograph. But still, such a small thing. She had just been waiting for the restroom, and Ryan had been sneaking a smoke, the back door propped open. She hadn't even known he smoked, but everyone was smoking that night. "Can I have one?" she asked, which meant she was drunk. She hadn't smoked in 20 years. He smiled, nodded. It was so meaningless, she'd mostly forgotten all about it.
She couldn't recall how they'd started talking about the book in his pocket, the one with the soft cover, pages curled, but suddenly it was in Katie's hand. Then he told her the same thing he'd told her before, about never reading as a kid and reading now, and how he loved the book so much and he didn't know why. It made her sad a little that he didn't remember telling her before.
"Let me show you," he said,
moving close behind her, leaning over her, cracking the book's many cracked spine, forcing its pages open. They smelled like smoke. So much taller, his forearm thrust in front of her, nearly grazing her collarbone or beneath it. And she thought there could be nothing more private than the inside of the forearm, the tenderest of skin, the push and throb of one blue vein, the way it arrowed to the soft center of his half-open palm. Resting her fingers on that skin, helping him keep the book open, she watched as he turned to the most dog-eared page, its corner folded down. She leaned close. It was dark. The hall was dark. The light covered with old kitchen grease like Vaseline gave everything a glow. On the page was a line drawing of a tombstone.
"But I don't just like it because there's pictures," he'd said, winking,
with words printed on it. They said, "Everything was beautiful, and nothing hurt." "What does it mean?" she asked. But he just kept grinning. His arms turned out, open, the book splayed. "Like your heart, inside out, splayed." Like he was saying,
"I'm giving you something. I'm giving this."
But instead he said,
"Your hands are hot."
And she realized she was still touching both his arms, her fingertips resting on them. And she should have been embarrassed, but she wasn't and didn't know why. But it was just a moment. It was just a moment. That was all. And no one saw. Could Devon have seen? Later, as she was leaving, she spotted him one more time. He'd found Devon's lei in the parking lot. She wanted to take it, but her arms were full of party favors.
"I know," he said.
Nearly slipping on the glassy pavement, he draped it over Katie's head. Everything was beautiful and nothing hurt. That was it, she realized now. She hadn't put it together before, the context so distinct. The same words Katie had seen in Devon's diary a month later, like you write a boy's favorite song lyric, the kind of thing you do in that first heat of infatuation, or love, or something. "Drew," she said into the phone, "I'm heading home now. I'll be there in less than a minute." There was a noise on his end, like a seashell. She remembered Drew explaining it to her once, that you're not just hearing air. Part of what you're hearing is yourself. "Your blood, even," he'd said. "You're hearing your own blood." "I'm hearing my blood," she thought now. "Drew, are you there? What's all the noise? Are you outside?" "Yeah," his voice came. "I can see you." "What?" Her foot on the brakes. Her eyes searched the road frantically. "I can see you by the tall trees." And there he was, tramping up the low hill in front of her, his hood pulled tight against his pink, thick face. He was breathing hard into the phone, pressed so close. "I'm hearing my own blood," she thought, running out of the car. "It's roaring." "Don't be mad, Mom," he kept saying. "It's only 9 blocks, just like you said." "Drew, that doesn't matter," she said, hands on his arms, her chest jerking. "You could have been run over. You could... But I had to tell you." "Tell me what?" "Dad called." "Why couldn't you call or wait until I got back?" "You were gone a long time." "I wasn't gone a long time." "You were gone for 80 minutes. 80 minutes? "Drew, something happened and Dad called twice and said he was at Devon's school. He sounded really weird. I never heard him sound like that." She looked at him. "Drew, what did Dad say to you exactly?" "He said they wouldn't let him take Devon out of school and that it was your fault. And he wanted to know where you were." "Okay," she said. "Okay. I said you were in the shower, but then you were away so long, I thought he might call back or something." He looked at her, a worried, almost paternal furrow in his brow. "So I thought I'd better find you." She looked at him and thought her heart might burst. "Mom," he said as she pulled him close, pressed him against her chest, the smell of chloroseptic and panic. "Are you okay?" The corridors were empty, but all the classroom doors were open, the June heat filling the old high school and stray sounds wafting, the chant of French verb conjugations, the squeak of moving chairs. One student's lone protestation.
I'm so hot, Mr. Maniar. Can we have class outside?
Drew kept wandering from her, staring up at the display cabinets, the team banners, the signs.
Stay strong, Jay Chong. And seniors, take the pledge today.
Also mysterious to Katie, who hadn't been inside the school since parent-teacher conferences months ago.
Devin,
Drew said, and she turned quickly. But he was only pointing to a bulletin board. 10th grade writing contest. Dreams, wishes, goals. Beneath it were the top three essays, and Devin's was number one. Always number one. Katie walked closer. She'd never even seen the essay, and Devin hadn't said anything about the contest. She started reading it, her eyes moving so fast the words seemed to smear.
My Dream, by Devin Emery Knox. I have never had any desire to be ordinary or normal. But to be extraordinary, one must learn to conquer weakness. I was 3 years old when I first set foot on the gymnastics beam. You were fearless, my parents tell me. They believed in me from the start. I was 7 when I got my first rip. A flap of skin the size of a nickel torn from the center of my palm. I knew what it was. All gymnasts get them, from the friction of your hands on the bars all day long. And I rubbed chalk on it and went straight back to the bars. Same with the jammed fingers, the wrist sprains, the hamstring that cost me a year. All those years, all that work, I can't believe I never got broken. Now I am almost 16, and I have known fear and failure. 2 years ago I had my crisis point. I faced a difficult vault. No, I did not fall, but I did fail. And it was because I was afraid I was weak. I didn't want it enough. Or I was afraid to want something so completely as my coach did, my parents do. They want everything for me. So for many months I became a slave to my weakness. I was afraid of falling, of landing on my neck, my head, of my bones breaking like wishbones, but most of all, of failing. I lived with that fear, saw it in the faces of others as they watched how close I came to falling, to losing. The greatest of all fears, and the one that can destroy you. My dad tried to fix it. He built me a landing pit, and he worked very hard to show me how important it was. But the day the pit was finished, I was afraid again. More afraid than ever. What if I don't want it enough? I asked my dad. He looked at me. Devin, I promise you, it's the reason you're here. This, he said, pointing to the vault, is why you're here. He was right, because my vault was perfect. I was fixed, and everyone loved me again. I learned that day that I must trample fear, and I must own my desire to be extraordinary. It has been hard. I had to learn how to go inside myself, places no one could touch or see. But I can say today that I am no longer afraid. I have learned to make fear my slave. Whenever I confront my own weakness, I look in the mirror and say, "You have taken things from me. You will take nothing more." Now it is only desire that rules me. Desire to win, yes, but also to be the best. To be extraordinary. It was like a picture of your life from an angle you'd never seen before. And Katie didn't know what to do with it. One hand pressing the paper, her other hand on her mouth. Then she saw it, across the bottom of the page, scrawled in giant diagonal letters and paper-tearing tugs, was a word. Freak! Underneath, someone had drawn a cartoon, lurid and X-rated. A girl whose head dwarfed her little naked body, doing a split, her hairless crotch exposed.
"She's in her history class right now," said the principal. An earnest-jawed man named Mr. Waltham, whom Katie had never met. "Room 112, if you'd like to check."
"I'm sorry about all this," Katie said. "My husband is having some medical issues."
"He seemed very upset," said the principal, who seemed upset himself. He seemed to believe we were being deliberately obstructive.
Her gaze falling nervously to Drew's pink, gummy face, the way he kept scratching at his scaly skin.
It's the medication talking. I'm very grateful, Katie said, grabbing Drew's hand. I won't bother you again.
We don't see too much of you two here, Mr. Waltham said, hoisting a smile. We'd been hoping to recruit Mr. Knox for the PTA, get him, both of you, involved more in school activities. I understand he's a very successful fundraiser.
Absolutely, Mr. Waltham. I promise.
She moved with purpose through the musty halls, Drew's hand, his delicate, peeling fingers in hers, past all the classrooms until she found the right one.
Seated in the far corner by the window was Devon, pencil in hand, her warm-up jacket sleeves creeping over her gnarled gymnast hands, as if she wanted to hide them, hair pulled into a bun, hard as a walnut. It had been a while, more than a while, since she'd seen Devon among so many other girls her age, non-gym girls, but whether thick-bodied or willowy, with cat's eyeglasses and braces, or thickly eyelinered and greasy foreheaded, or donning day-glow nail polish and a do-rag, they all looked so much more like one another than like Devon. None of them looked anything like Devon.
When had they all developed these bodies? Whether hard little tennis balls or absurdly luxuriant breasts stretched beneath straining T-shirts, and hips that seemed to sway and undulate even when they shifted in their seats, stretching across revealing ample fleshy waists and downy hair. They were women, or close enough. And a few feet apart from them, in her quiet corner, her pencil moving, her eyes on the teacher, on the whiteboard, on something, sat her tiny Herculean daughter, stallion thighs stretched against the denim of her jeans, her face wan and small, her feet misshapen and scarred, hidden in her softest pair of sneakers. Nearly 16, fearless, extraordinary. Like no one else, only like herself. Whoever that was. The bell rang, the door pushed open, and Katie retreated quietly into the crowd. Book bag swung over her shoulder, all the boys, most of the girls, towering over her. Devon hurried out to her next class.
"Hey, baby Gap," one jug-jawed boy called out. "Can you carry my bag, too?" "But look at those thighs," another added, grinning, his teeth monstrous. "Wrap those thighs around my cock, baby Gap." "Watch out for her toes. They look like nutcrackers to me." "I'd let her work my beam any day. But what do you hold on to except biceps?"
Devon walking and walking, never turning her head. Back in the car, Drunan asked what was going on with his dad, what had happened at the Belfours, why the police had come to the house. It was as if he knew she wouldn't be able to answer, the noise in her head so loud. They were driving on Sparrow's Way when she noticed the turnoff, spotted the flutter of yellow tape through the trees. Ash Road. "That's the spot," Drew said, as if reading her mind.
"Yes," she decided in an instant, turning the wheel hard, the gears gnashing. "It is."
But the minute her tires landed on Ash Road's soft asphalt, she regretted it.
"Except the pictures from the other side," Drew said.
"What picture?" she asked. But something began sliding into place in her head.
"Ryan's picture."
Pulling the car onto the road's shoulder, she stopped the engine, hands shaking on keys.
"The one on his refrigerator," she said, realizing it.
The snapshot, taped to Ryan's fridge door, a blur of greenery, the swampy colors of a cheap printer.
"This is the place."
"Yeah,"
Drew said, almost a sigh. Looking at him, a revelation felt close, just beyond her grasp. The yellow tape twisted, held pockets of dew, rain.
"Drew, go back in the car, okay?"
A raid on the dirt road, spilling onto the shoulder, were a series of small fluorescent flags, mud-splattered, bending in the wind. Each flag had a number, marking something. Maybe a gouge in the dirt. Glass fragments, a heel print.
They looked so festive, like miniature versions of the scoring flags judges flashed at meets, or the parade of flags at the Olympics. A few cars sped by, jolting her as she walked along the shoulder, the dirt beneath her dusting up the sides of her shoes. Hairpin turn. That's what everyone always said, but it was just a sharp one, and not blind at all. Her sneakers, half untied like a sloppy teenager's, slid on the shoulder, the dirt sandy, almost like silk. The edge was so steep you could imagine at night, with street lamps several spans away, getting turned around, getting lost inside yourself. Off the shoulder there was a drop, and a shallow ditch heavy with old rain, filmy pools of motor oil floating on top. One lone flag lay flat in the water, spinning like a propeller, like those whirlybird seeds that fell from the maples. This was where Ryan fell. His body knocked, hurled, jettisoned. "There were no skid marks on the road," the reporter said. "Whoever the driver was, he never even set his foot on the brake." The silver car never stopped. The shallow ravine looked scraped clean. Long rake grooves thatched across, combed for evidence, for glass, for paint. As the slope cantered down, it was like the earth folded up upon itself, a green swoop, a pelt of foliage at its center. Even though it was daylight, just shy of noon, it was the darkest place she'd ever seen, a cut in the earth.
"I saw one of his shoes."
That was what Eric had said, nearly asleep, and holding her arm, stroking it, the night after they'd heard the news, after he'd been to Ash Road. She thought about Ryan's shoe tumbling down, one lace spinning like a whirligig.
"I saw it,"
Eric had told her, his voice mournful, lost. Now the words sounded different, meant something different.
"I saw it."
Because he was there when it happened.
"Why did Ryan have a picture of the place he died right on his refrigerator?" Drew said, standing next to the car.
Katie didn't say anything for a moment. "Maybe it was his favorite place to walk," she tried, finally.
Drew looked around doubtfully.
"Maybe if you didn't want anyone to see you," Katie said, thinking.
"Maybe.
Or something else. A meeting place. A lover's rendezvous point. One that sentimental Ryan kept a photo of on his refrigerator door." Now Katie could see it.
"There's 100 ways sex can ruin you."
That was Eric's doomful warning to Devon. Amid the balloons and banners of Lacey Weaver's party, had Devon gotten a call? A text? Not from Haley, but from Ryan.
"Meet me at the turn in Ash Road. You know the spot."
He must have.
"There's 100 ways sex can ruin you."
And he wouldn't let it, wouldn't let her. Did Eric find out?
"Why are you going down there, Mom?"
"Just to see."
She eased down into the shallow ravine. Drew was looking at her, eyes black under the overcast sky. A wind glittered up glass and leaves as she eased down, as she saw. Paint, glass. There were hundreds of chips, fragments, specks, shards. And Ryan had fallen down here, and there were a million flecks of ephemera that could have pressed into the folds of his clothing, scattered through his hair. She realized it in a flash. The police will never know who hit him, not for sure, not with all this. So much glitter, a mad confetti, from a decade or more of bottles lobbed from car windows, from battered fenders, a car hood into a tree stump, teens stalking in the woods, 40s in hand in pursuit of magic and mayhem. Like the time she and Eric, that first wild summer, got caught trespassing in the woods behind the church, running from the security guard, laughing and huffing in cold air, then Eric trying to boost her over a wire fence and her sandal caught in one of the zigzag hooks. Trapped at the top, she couldn't shake it loose, her chest pressed against the chain mesh, laughing so hard and crying so hard she couldn't move. The fence left diamonds on her chest for days. The most brilliant of tattoos. A lifetime of good luck, Eric promised. Diamonds are forever, right?
"Like hog rings," her mother said when she saw them, shaking her head.
"And that guy's never going to marry you."
But then he did. He did. Devon inside her already, waiting.
He did. At the end of the summer, she told herself she loved him so much, she would rather die than lose him. And she still felt it. Because there's 100 ways sex can ruin you, but there's no end to the ways love can. Walking back up the slope, she heard something, a branch cracking, and she could feel her ankle turning, her body starting to pitch forward, and suddenly Drew appeared, his hand grabbing for her, trying to hold on to her. Mom! She caught herself, dug her heel hard into the mud, steadied them both. Thanks, sweetie, she said. I'm okay. But there was a look on Drew's face she'd never seen, his hands gripping her impossibly hard as if she were still falling. Mom, I want to go home, Drew whispered. I wanted to for the longest time.
Chapter 20. He didn't say anything during the short drive, but when she pulled into the garage, Drew grabbed her arm, the seatbelt straining.
Mom, why did you leave me by myself?
She unfastened her belt, turned and faced him.
Drew, I'm sorry, I had to see Teddy. A lot is happening now, things I need to take care of. Why do you always leave me by myself?
He said it louder, with startling firmness.
Honey, I don't, and I'm sorry. I'm always by myself.
She looked at him, those coffee bean eyes, and put her hand to his forehead.
Did you get spooked, honey? I thought maybe I'd get in trouble for leaving. But I had to because Dad was so weird.
No, she said.
You're not in trouble. And I'm so sorry.
He nodded vaguely. That was when she noticed it, perched on the utility shelf, the 2-liter bottle studded with rock salt, clouded pink. The remnants of Drew's science project, abandoned due to illness, the second failed attempt.
Drew, she said. The brine shrimp in the oil? What happened the first time?
He paused, throat clicking.
Remember? I had to throw them away.
Why?
You know, they spilled. That's why I put them up higher this time. But then I got sick.
How did they spill? She only remembered Drew telling her. The night after they found out about Ryan. The night after Ryan died. Drew looked at her. And Katie was alarmed to see his chin shaking.
Maybe she didn't want me to win the science fair.
What?
Maybe that's why she did it. She never won a science fair.
Who?
Devin! You told me to put the container in the garage while they hatched, and she knocked it over with Dad's car. So they all died.
What? She said again, kept saying, something throbbing in her head.
Devin doesn't drive by herself. She doesn't even have her license.
I kept telling you she was. You said I was dreaming. I'd hear her in the garage at night. I told Dad.
Katie looked up at the garage ceiling, Drew's room right above it.
I told him a long time ago, like when it was Easter. I said Devin sometimes took his car after we all went to sleep, or early before the newspaper came.
Drew? Sneaking in the garage, sneaking the car out, the constant rumble and traffic of their home, the garage door open most of the time. Was it possible?
I guess Dad finally caught her. I heard them in here. I went to check on the shrimp and I saw them through the door crack. She was crying. She was crying and he couldn't get her to come out of the car and she kept holding the wheel except the car wasn't on anymore. She was holding it tight like you are now.
Katie looked down at her hands, shaking.
He kept telling her she needed to be quiet, Drew said, that Mom would hear.
Katie nodded.
She was crying and she wouldn't stop. She sounded funny. I never saw her cry. And then Dad stopped yelling. He told her he would fix things.
Drew, she said, looking down at him. This was a week ago Saturday, wasn't it? The night Ryan died. He didn't say anything, breathing softly.
Drew?
He nodded. As if in some silent agreement, they both opened their car doors, stepped out. When she tried to reach for him, he moved away, pointing down at the floor, not looking at her.
I went in after, he said. The plastic bottle was stuck under the tire. I couldn't pull it loose. She knocked all the water out and all the eggs, too. They died before they were real.
They weren't real yet, Drew, I promise.
But they were going to die anyway, he said, once I put the oil in.
He paused.
Maybe Devin didn't want me to win.
Drew, taking a breath, Katie reached for his arm. You know this is about more than your experiment, don't you?
He paused, and in that pause Katie saw his little face, aged 10 years. Then he nodded.
Oh, Drew, she said, her hand on his arm tighter now. Why didn't you tell me?
He didn't say anything, plucking at the peeling skin on his temple.
You know what you're telling me, right? About your sister?
He nodded.
You've known all along?
He looked at her, eyes glassy and bottomless, and said,
Yeah, Mom.
Rummaging through the recycling, she couldn't find an empty 2-liter. 3 doors down, she lifted the lid on the biggest bin on the block and took 2. She had decided it was to be their lost hour. An amnesia, an hour free from everything else that happened, was happening. Maybe it was a kind of madness, but it was the least she owed him. Drew rinsed the bottles. Then she took the bread knife and sliced off the tops. Together they filled them with water and salt. They marked the water line with Sharpie to monitor evaporation, and then Drew sprinkled the eggs inside. Katie cleared everything from the high shelf in the TV room. All of Devin's trophies, 3 Bellstars albums. She dumped them on the sofa, dust gusting.
It'll be safe here, she said, setting the 2 liters down on the swollen wood.
Yeah,
Drew nodded.
They hatch in 2 days?
Then we add the motor oil and check under the microscope every 10 minutes for an hour to see if they're still kicking.
Okay. Drew looked up at the plastic containers. The cloudy water. The shrimp far too small to see.
I don't want to add it, really, he said. It seems mean.
It's not mean, she said. It's nature. The phone call came just as they finished.
Devin?
Katie answered, her voice shaking.
Devin! Mom!
Devin's voice, like a claw over Katie's heart.
Guess what? Everything's back. Coach T is holding practice today. Can you believe it? Mrs. Chu's here at school. She's going to drive me and Cheyenne.
She sounded so buoyant as Katie had heard her in months.
Devin, no, she said. I'm coming to get you right now. I'm taking you home. We need to talk. I can't hear you, Mom, she said.
Cheyenne squeals in the background, the sound of doors slamming, an engine starting, and Molly Chu's excitable voice.
Hurry up, girls. There's bound to be Devin, wait, she said.
But Devin didn't hear. When Katie tried to call back, she got voicemail. When she called Molly, she got voicemail. As she set the phone down, it rang again.
Kirsten?
Did you hear? Coach T is back. That sly dog, he must have known his days were numbered.
Listen, can you take Jordan? I'm at work, and
Devin's on her way with Molly.
God damn it,
Kirsten said.
God damn it!
So she misses today.
I bet you'd like that.
Excuse me? I'm sorry, Kirsten said quickly. Then she sighed, her voice wobbly.
But I have a career.
We all work, Katie said. All of us.
I have clients. Sometimes I think I'm just working to keep Jordan in those goddamn $200 leotards. Don't you ever get tired?
I'm tired all the time, Katie replied, her hand covering her face, the smell of the salt under her fingernails.
Kirsten, I have to go.
You and Eric just never miss a beat. The gym in the basement, the library of Olympic DVDs. When Devin's down on the floor, you and Eric in your matching Bellstars shirts doing the counts with her, moving when she moves.
God, I just don't have that kind of time,
Kirsten said, sighing.
And Jordan blames me for it, I know she does.
Kirsten,
Katie said, a voice coming from somewhere.
A voice hard and cool. I know you wish Jordan were half the athlete Devin is, and I know you wish that the difference was just a matter of you having more time to devote to her. And it's not because you don't commit like we commit.
It's because Jordan isn't that good. She's ordinary.
Jesus, Katie.
And when you have an extraordinary